So just to do a little scan here, psychic scan on yourself. It's good to know what you're walking around with at work or at home or getting out of bed in the morning. What are you getting out of bed with? Sometimes dreams have left their own imprint. We can carry those emotional residues with us for some time, not even knowing we're doing it. And it has no bearing on anything. But it has a tremendous impact upon how we behave. So, we're the owners of that. We have to be accountable for what we decide to bring along with ourselves. Now, I'd also like to suggest that as you're sitting down in respect to this meditation, that you release yourself from the past. That you really see that there is a renewability available to you. You can renew yourself. Just let it go. What does it have to do with anything anyway? What does it have to do with this moment? What does it really have to do with this moment, you see? If it has to do with something, you can certainly access it later. But why carry it around continuously? Because we've learned to do that. So as we begin our meditation, deeply relax into your sitting posture, keeping your back straight, your shoulders square. If you're on a chair, leaning your back away from the back of the chair, not resting your back on the back of the chair. If you're sitting on the floor, some of you look a little folded in, so take a moment and just tuck your chin in, square your shoulders, straighten your back. This posture has a psychic effect on us as well. If you slump over, well, that says a lot about what's going on inside. If you sit straight, that's the maximum posture for alert attention. And then as we rest and relax comfortably into that posture, think of the image of a coat on a coat hanger. It's not tight or tense, it's folded around the hanger. So to let your body fold around the frame of your skeletal system. And just begin to relax the areas of your body, the head and facial areas, the eyes and the jaw, softening the brain itself so that you're not struggling or tight or tense internally. Relaxing the neck and allowing the shoulders to drop away from the neck. The chest area and the belly. So that when the body breathes itself, you're not forcing a breath or trying to control your breathing, you're just letting the body breathe naturally. You'll notice that there are physical sensations associated with that breath. And our job early on is to stay focused upon those physical sensations. Accompanying those physical sensations is often a narrative or a commentary about what's going on. It may have to do with those physical sensations, or it may have to do with something else that's completely abstract and distant from that. Whenever you see yourself siding with the thought, and you realize you're doing so, even if it's been minutes, don't come back with any self-brutality or deprecation. Just simply be willing to begin again. And the best way to do that is to go towards the physical relaxation of the body and let the breath find you. If you carry the attitude of having lost the breath back into the breath, you'll already be tight and tense when you reconnect to the breath. That's not so helpful. And then we're just going to open up to see what's there psychically within us, to see if there are other competing sensations, either physical or mental, that call our attention away from the breath. And then, if they do so, we can bring our attention to those competing sensations. It can be another physical sensation, like an itch, or feelings of heat or cold, or perhaps the touch of wind on our body, or perhaps most frequently, you'll feel pain or something unpleasant the body is going through. Being present to them. Not denying it's there or looking away from it, but being present to the difficult as well as the pleasant. If there's an emotional response that becomes obvious as you're sitting, just feeling it for what its life is, letting the life of the emotion express itself. Sometimes it's felt as a physical sensation, you feel it as a part of the body, other times as an emotional mind state. But be careful not to hook a content, an explanation with it, because that will just carry you away into the abstract, into the justification of the emotion. So stay grounded, body grounded. If one of the hindrances might arise, desire, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, or doubt, being aware that that's active, that's an active expression of mind. Oh, desiring, okay, got it. Once you're identifying with it, once you're not identifying with it, but seeing it for what it is, that's 50% of the solution. Allowing it to be what it is. Giving it space. Sometimes the mind gets very contracted. Perhaps there are a lot of emotions occurring. Maybe there is pain in the body. Then it could be helpful just to listen for a while. Just to hear what the ear hears. Letting the space, the psychic space, become broad and expansive. So the sound of the heater, or the sound of my voice, or the sound of other sounds in the room. Remembering that it's what the ear hears, not what we think about it, that's important. If you go by the way of what we think about it, then you'll be lost in the abstract again, the conceptual explanation of it, which will lead you astray. Today, we're going to expand the field of our attention to include the most subtle aspect of mind, and that's thought. In the beginning, it's helpful just to know that thought is occurring. So when you know you're thinking, just knowing that you're thinking, that's enough. Oftentimes that will happen after the event. You will have sat for a while and then be swept away with a thought and dwell upon that thought for some minutes perhaps. And then you'll come out of it and you think, oh, I've been thinking. That's good enough. Don't demand too much too quickly. It's very difficult to pick thoughts up. Sometimes, as you practice deepens, you'll know you're thinking as you're thinking. Oh, I'm thinking right now. Well, that's interesting. Again, when you lose your ground with the thought, then come back to the ground of your physicality, of the physical quality of your experience. The breath, another physical sensation. At another time, when your practice deepens, opening up to the whole display of mind and body as it's arising. As I mentioned, it's like standing on the corner. In the beginning, we notice each car that's passing. And we focus in on each car, the physical sensation, the emotion, the sound. At another point, we can stand on the corner, and the field of our attention is broad enough so that it sees all the cars that are passing inclusively. Don't try to get there too soon. You'll naturally evolve out of that one point and moment to moment mindfulness where you're seeing each car individually into the more expansive mindfulness, where you're aware of what it is that's occurring within the broader expanse of your attention. For now, just noticing as best as you can that you're thinking when you're thinking. Don't fight your thoughts, because that which fights the thought is another thought. And you'll never win that. For whatever you say to the thought is really the thought working against you. So just simply drop the need to have to think. Begin to love the quiet that's there in the absence of thinking. Begin to treasure the quietude, the stillness. Remembering when anything arises that seems to disturb or confuse or burden you in any way, remember simply relax to whatever is arising. Observe what's occurring. Allow it to be there for as long as it is. Relax, observe, and allow. That's how you befriend life. That's how you include life. We interrupt life. We create the stress by not observing it, by turning away, by denying that it's there, by being tight and tense when it does arise, so that we're in an aggressive posture to whatever it is that's occurring. Or by shutting down and not accepting that this is a part of my psyche. That it doesn't mean anything. It just is arising. The arisal doesn't define you. It's only there for as long as it lasts. For as long as it lasts. That's all. Our job is to allow all of those visitors to come through the door. Now I'll be quiet and we'll sit for the next 15 minutes. So bring yourself back if you've been away from yourself, just release the need to have to think, that's all. Knowing that you have been thinking, ending the sitting with a Rumi poem. In the arms of the beloved. O seeker, these thoughts have such control over you. From nothing you become sad. From nothing you become happy. You are burning in the flames of your own making. But I will not let you out until you are fully baked, fully wise, and fully yourself. From nothing, you become sad. Let each ring of the bell deepen your sense of relaxation and ease. No tightness or tension as we begin to come out of our meditation. We bring the same alert attention we were offering our meditation. By opening our eyes quietly and seeing what's there. Soft eyes, soft eyes. So you're welcome to stand up and stretch if you'd like. So tonight I'd like to speak about thought. Trying not to make it too abstract. Okay, so I want to give you an analogy of thought that I think you can get your senses around. And that is when you go to a movie theater, you're sitting in the audience, before the projector begins, there's just the screen. And in the old days, I don't know how they do it anymore, but there was a light that shone from the projector through a film, and the image of the film was what was presented on the screen. Actually, the light was what hit the screen, right? And the shades of the images were just variations of the light that were there. Now, not very many of us would pay our money and go see a screen that just had the light and no images. We want the images because the images give us the entertainment, don't they? They give us the story, they give us the narrative. We empathetically follow the narrative through the course of our own emotional reactions, etc. Within the context of how we live, we can relate to the movie. And so we give over our energies, we give over our intention to the series of images that portray and dance across the screen. But what's actually there is light, different shades of light and shadow that the projector is holding on that screen. It's the light that we see. And we make believe we see a real life series of events from these lights and shadows that dance across the screen. But again, we go to the movie for the images. That's what we want. We take some popcorn in with us. It's the entertaining facet of the movie. Now, I just want to superimpose yesterday's Super Bowl upon that analogy. There it is, you see. the glitz, the glamour, the lights, the attraction, the sounds, everything dancing across the screen. And the occasion, you know, and the hyperbole, and the fantasy of it all. And that's what we spent 3 or 4 hours, perhaps some of us spent 3 or 4 hours watching in the course of that time together. Now I want to contrast that period of time with another period of time, which I know as Northwesterners you've all had, and that is a walk in the woods, where you've been out, if woods or the wilderness attracts you, or perhaps skiing, or just perhaps in your garden in the back of your house, where there's no glitz or glamour, there's nothing that's compelling the psyche forward, there aren't a series of images, there's quietude, simplicity, naturalness, authenticity. You're not demanding anything in the walking. You're just listening to what's there. You're hearing the birds. And quite possibly, you're deeply moved by that experience. In fact, many people seek refuge in the woods because it's a spiritual experience. It's hard to say that watching the Super Bowl is a spiritual experience. It's a worldly experience of extraordinary extravagance, but we wouldn't say we are deeply moved by it. At least I wouldn't. I wouldn't say that I was deeply touched by the Super Bowl, but I would in my walk in the woods. I wouldn't say that very much got in, except my opinions about who should be winning and who wasn't, or how loud the music was, or the glitz and glamour, or whether the commercial was. But it doesn't take much to be affected with an A by a walk in the woods. Perhaps it was just a passing bird. Perhaps it was the sound or the smell or something. Or perhaps it was just the sight of the open embrace of what's naturally around us. And you can sense that being in nature arouses what's naturally in us, arouses a sense of familiarity. Much of what it's like when you're deeply practiced in meditation of just moving inside quietly. Just being with yourself, allowing whatever is there to move you, to be known to you. Instead of it being the sound of a bird, it's the sound of your own thought, or perhaps an emotion that's arising, or perhaps the digestion of a particular portion of meal or something that's going on in your body. We get a very different sense of our place on earth when we are surrounded by the natural as opposed to the artificial. But the artificial offers us something that the natural doesn't. It offers us a pursuit of the pleasant. It offers us a world in which we can compound the images, the hyperbole. We can keep building the crescendo of life so that it's the orchestration of it. Bring in the brass. We can orchestrate it. We can conduct it. We can choose the movie and whether we want the genre of drama or comedy. And so, too, we have internalized that ability in ourselves through our mind's thinking. We have learned how to orchestrate our life so that it carries forth the entertainment quality that we seek. I mean, instead of sitting 30 minutes a day, you can think about your vacation last year. You can go back to your first encounter with whomever. You can remember your whole life at different periods and different occasions that were extremely pleasurable to you. That's what the ability of the mind has. It has the ability to go anywhere you want, anytime you want. It's like having a ticket to the best movies available to you, scripted. The only problem is that it's artificial. It's not really happening. It's a movie. But we don't want to be told that quite yet, you see. We don't want to have to go in, and as we're buying our ticket to the movie that's an Oscar nominee, somebody's telling us, well, you know, it's not really true. We don't want to hear that. So, as I mentioned in an earlier talk, we have invested in this ability to manufacture images to such a degree that we've lost its reference. It was meant to show us a possibility of a solution to the problem of survival, so that we could see a stick as a spear and use it so that we wouldn't be eaten, that we would ascend the food chain. The problem with focusing on the spear for survival is that once that connection between survival and imagination becomes conditioned together, links together, we now use that for other things other than survival. And so we begin to create images in ourselves that are not needed for survival, but are just needed for the fun and pleasure of things. The problem with the images that we place upon the world is that they're not real. They're fictitious, they're mind created. They're from our memory or our belief projected upon the world. Everything we see around us tonight is ascribed by our mind upon those objects. We have a visual memory, perception, that creates a mental image of what we see. We don't see this. We see flower and vase. And how do we know it to be a flower and vase? Because we've had experiences with flowers and vases. And so we then generalize from those past experiences to make this specific reference from our memory. So we see through our memory. We see through our thinking. That shouldn't be a surprise to you now. Because when you sit down and you try not to think, you can't. The thoughts are coming up all the time. They're regurgitating themselves from the neurological responses. The neurons are firing. And as they fire, sight, perception sees through those images, those thoughts that cannot be stopped. And the world that we depict looks like the movies we see to pay tickets to. Not the screen with a light upon it, but the fast-moving images that hold a narrative and a tale, all laced together by what I'm telling myself is happening on that fictitious series of images. Our personal narrative that accompanies our thinking, the personal story we give life, is set off, sets itself off through a single word. Suppose we were sitting and listening and we heard a dog bark. Most of us if we were not being aware of that, we would immediately run to the fact that that was a dog. Sound like a large dog. I have a large dog, or I used to have a large dog. I wonder if it's the same kind of large dog. That sounded like a more ferocious dog than I had. I love dogs. Out it goes. It's called, in this tradition, papancha. The proliferation of thought, like putting water on oil. It spreads itself immediately like that across the landscape. And you can't reel it back in. And it holds a whole fiction of a movie, an internal movie, script, everything. Usually governed by a kind of pain that we each hold about ourselves. If somebody looks at us strangely, we ascribe that look, that glance, not according to what they might have been thinking at that time, but according to how disadvantaged we are in the moment we see the glance. Oh, he thinks I'm strange, we might say. Or he thinks I'm awkward, or he sees me as I really am. And then we create a whole story from the fabrication of our own pain. Our pain is always ready to meet the situation through a single glance, a movement, an awkward movement, anything that we can relate to a past memory in which we were blamed or fill in the blank. We set ourselves off. We have countless movies going on all the time. The problem is that they're not true. I was attending a day-long with a woman named Byron Katie, and there were 750 people. And she's a remarkable woman. She's very awake. And she had people relate a particular difficult moment. And how she did that is that she would have you come back into that difficult time, that moment. She would have you relive it. And then what you were saying to yourself about what was actually going on, or you thought was going on, and the comments and the opinions that you had about the situation. And she would have you write those down and look at them. And then you would have to look at those in regards to them coming from your own pain. So you would see that person who you thought didn't like you, you really didn't know whether they liked you or not. And once you started questioning your story and the conclusions you drew from your story, you saw that the whole fabricated argument fell apart. And then it did repeatedly, again and again and again. And her guidance was for us to really call ourselves back to these stated truths that we think are so substantially there and question them. And you begin to see that your life of projection, your life of storytelling, caves in upon itself. That's essential. If we're going to come out of this thing with any kind of sanity, just think of the stories we tell ourselves and the papancha that moves out from that. We have a relationship, and let us say for some reason that person leaves us. And because of the pain of our own sense of isolation or loneliness, we immediately put a story on that breakup. Oh, I will never find anyone again. He was the only one, or she was the only one who I could ever be coupled to. I'll be miserable the rest of my life. These are sentences we tell ourselves conclusively. We think they're accurate. The only person that I can ever... I will never be happy again. Those are so obviously fictitious, but we don't know it as we're saying them. We're saying them with the complete confirmation of the truth of our pain, because our pain holds a kind of solidity of truth. I am not lovable, it says. And so, of course, I'll never find anyone else again. We have to bring this thing back. We have to reel it in. We have to begin to see that this is a projection of images across a screen. We have to see the stick as a stick rather than as a spear. As soon as we see something as being other than what it is, we're into the papancha mode of life, into the storytelling. And it's hard to contract water after it's touched oil. It's hard to regroup it, to corral it back into itself. It's up to us. I mean, you can have a Super Bowl life. The problem is that you won't stay in a Super Bowl life. You'll also have its opposite, the hells of life, of equal low to the high you seek, because that's the way it goes. If you seek this at point at plus five, you will certainly fall to a minus five when that absence of that stimulation isn't there. So if you want a roller coaster life, then Super Bowl is the way forward. If you want a life in which you have some sanity and walking in nature, where you are settled in yourself, where you have some reasonable ground under your feet, where you have a sense of your own proportionality and your own stance and posture on the earth, where the small, quiet things of life touch you very deeply, we have to go below the surface tension of our concepts. The conceptual surface tension creates the life of abstraction, the life of images. It will not give us the life of natural ease and contentment. It just doesn't hold that. That's not its point, its purpose. I'm not saying that we should throw thought away. I'm saying we should use it relatively. When it's useful, when it's needed, when I have to think myself forward, then fine. When I don't keep thinking. I let thought inform my life rather than direct it. And then I can use it as a skillful tool, a creative tool, but I can always take the walk in the woods that's there waiting for me. It's that close. Being natural and authentic. It's that close. Do you think we're some species that has no governance by the wild nature? We are that nature. We've just created a tension that we live above. In the abstract world of our mind doesn't allow us to touch the fabric, the core of that nature. Let me show you how crazy it gets, if you aren't convinced yet. Time. All of the ways that we keep ourselves stressfully moving forward, pushing ourselves with tension, entirely fabricated. Why do I say that? Because time internally is a thought about the past or the future. Where is the past or future? If it's true, please show it to me. And I will agree with you that you should be pushed around by it. But if you can't show it to me, then you have to agree with me that it's fictitious and that it's mind created. No one's ever been able to show it to me. Because it isn't here. It's here. It's a thought about what has been or what will be. And if it's a thought believed, it has the burden of that belief system. And we lockstep ourselves into time, pushing ourselves forward. I gave you a very simple homework assignment to find a marker each day and do that one thing and that one thing only. And I know, and I don't even have to ask you, that it was the hardest homework assignment I could have given. Because when you start doing it, what happens? You start thinking ahead of what you're doing. Because that's the normal way we meet any activity. We don't think about the activity. The walking meditation is meant to bring us back in, to reel us back in. So that time, we don't participate or push ourselves in terms of time. We see that there's a possibility of stepping outside of time and still staying in movement. Here's what the mind does, because the mind is so addicted to time. It says, when I don't have time to push me forward, I have no meaning. There's no purpose to what I'm doing. This, therefore, it's boring. If I'm not walking towards something to acquire or grasp that something, then the movement I have forward is wasted. It has no meaning. And so we keep breathing time into our psyche in order to have meaning, to have purpose. I've got to get there in 10 minutes so that I purposely arrive to meet the activities that I think are going to be happening, and on our day goes. So what's the value of that? The value of that is that it keeps you from being present now, if that's a value. So that you never have to look at yourself. You never have to feel the intimacy of your own nature. That you can live outside yourself, three steps away. You can live in the past. Most of us do live in the past. We compel ourselves to live in the past, and we think we should need to work out the past, as if it were something that could be changed. No one has ever changed the past. It's in the books, people. It's written. It's there. It's the volume 3, you can see everything you did. You're not going to change a word of it. And yet much of our activity, our lack of forgiveness, our despondency, is that we have had this past. And our emotions get hooked up to the same imagery. And so when an emotion arises, it's not just an emotion. It has its whole past association with what that emotion meant to me when I was growing up. Grief. I lost my parent when I was 5. And when grief arises, I'm back mourning my... It's that. That's what happens to us. And then we feed that emotion with more thoughts about what's going to happen now, similar to what happened back then. And so the thoughts feed the emotion. The emotion is tried to justify by the thoughts. The thoughts, all the thought is doing, the reason that we have circular thinking that goes around and around and around and it never solves anything, is it's trying to solve the emotion that you have. And we don't even know we have an emotion. Why am I thinking like this is driving me crazy? Look and see what emotion you're having that's driving you crazy. And the thought is trying to justify or solve that emotion. There is no solution to an emotion. It's an experience. It has to be experienced. It can't be explained. But we think, the fact that I'm having this emotion means there's something wrong with me, or I wouldn't be having this emotion. That's the first thing that's wrong, is the fact that everyone has every emotion. No, I've got, this is because my mother. This is because of what my mother did. Now, what does that do for you? That gives you justification for having the emotion. Now it's not your fault anymore. You don't even have to be accountable for it, do you? Your mother made you this way. The problem is that it's there inside of you. that it has. We have to each be accountable to our own internal life. We can't go blaming it on our parents. We have to live with this thing and find a new relationship to those emotions. Not tack them on, this is not my emotion, this is my mother who gave me this one. Doesn't do any good. Therapists. It's just insane. There's no explaining yourself out of an emotion. There isn't. It's just life. Just life lived in the moment. There's just the screen and the images that are dancing across the screen. And we can either choose to join that image, or we can sit knowing very well that we're in the audience. And we're just fine with that, because there's peace here, there's quiet here, there's sanity here. You see, now, if I'm saying this in truth, which I am, there should be a resonance in you, that you know that. You know that something is being said that's true. Truth just, it doesn't come, it's not like a foreign visitor. It resonates deeply with something we know about ourselves, but we haven't given it justifiable credence. If you're having that sense that what is being said fits, then don't stay within this madness. It's time we stepped out of this. Don't stay within the tyranny of time. Start watching it. You see, you're not going to want to get out of it until you see what the investment you're offering it and what it's doing to you. As soon as you start watching how time affects you, how you can't even brush your teeth without thinking of what you're going to be doing next, and that you don't care what the experience is now, because what is going to come up is far richer and better than the brushing that's occurring now. And so we move through our life not with any kind of stability of heart or openness or inclusiveness of the present moment. We're always thinking in terms of the future, because the future is what holds our hope, what holds the expectation of a better future. And so we give no credibility to the present moment. And yet it's in the present where everything lives. It's not... If it lives somewhere else, I'd be the first one there. It doesn't live anywhere else. Just feel it. Feel it. Just whoa. This feels like walking in the woods. This feels like being affirmed. As we get quieter, we consent to know less. The quiet takes the knowing from us. The assurance. The knowing sets us up to know more. To have noise. I know this, I know that. I know. It sets us up to have a storyline and a narrative. When we're quiet, we just see. We just hear. We just feel. Drawing from last week's talk, that's the opening of the heart. That's the true inclusiveness. That's the being truly affected by life, with an A. Allowing life to come in, not crowding it out with our knowledge, but letting it in through the quietness and simplicity of the moment. You feel it. You feel life around you. You feel a part of life. I don't know about you, but I used to think, oh, life is happening to me, as if I was sort of a bystander to it. How could life be happening to us when we are a part of life? That already shows that something's off. Major problem here. That I'm on a voyage through life. This should feel like a single event, really. A single arising. Just our willingness to choose between the crescendo of the halftime of the Super Bowl and the walk in the woods. Which one feeds your heart? Which one feeds your spirit? Which one allows you to be affirmed as a human being? Which one shows you your place in life? Which one credits that location? It's very simple and very obvious where our fulfillment lies. That's what meditation is meant to do. Thank you. Can we just sit for a minute or two? Okay, so we're going to go to walking meditation. And here's the instruction for walking meditation. Walk open-heartedly. Walk as if you meant to walk. Walk as if you knew where you were in life. And go wherever it is that you've been walking, and I'll call us back in 20 minutes. If you practice knowing where you are, wherever you are, there will be a growing confidence in you that you're in your rightful place. So much of our inward pain is that we think we're out of place. We said the wrong thing, that we shouldn't be here, we have no right to be here. This constant interplay of thought against our pain, against our sense of unworthiness, keeps us very off balance. But as we settle into the balanced feel of our own posture, a growing confidence arises where we look life straight in the eye without any apology. And we say, in essence, I'm here. This is where I am. This is where I belong. And we know that place perhaps for the first time. We have a lot to talk about today, but let me give you an opportunity to ask any questions you might have.
Do you think social media and being able to portray pictures out there have heightened this kind of, like you said, like the roller coaster of wanting to like kind of make this perfect real thing, or is it something that's been going on forever?
has the social media heightened this sense of being off our center? Or has it been going on forever? It's been going on forever. We find new ways to distract ourselves or to keep ourselves distant. I don't have a lot of research knowledge on whether the social medias, the cell phones that we have, are creating more havoc. They make us feel artificially connected, but so does most of our conversation. We feel like we're connecting, but we're connecting through the abstract. That's not real connection. To really listen to someone, to really listen, to let them in, you have to be free of thought. We have to actually listen to them without our own commentary. If our commentary runs up against their commentary, it's two commentaries meeting, and you never meet through that. It's just my opinions versus yours, or what I'm thinking about what you're saying as opposed to listening to. So it requires a quietude to actually connect, to actually feel someone else. And I don't find many people willing to be that quiet with one.
I find that interesting, your comparison between the Super Bowl and walking in the woods. I wonder what the experience would be if you were at the Super Bowl and watching the walking in the woods on TV.
It was just an analogy. Walking in the woods in the Super Bowl was the question. You can be present in the middle of the Super Bowl if you know what's going on around you. Right? If you're invested in the entertainment quality and give yourself away to the abstract fantasies that's playing in front of you, you will not know where you are. We will not be in the Super Bowl. We'll be with playing the fantasy. You can always know that you're in the audience watching the movie simply by being aware of the body in the audience. So no matter what the situation, circumstances, or what the stimulus are, there's always the ability to be awake within that stimulation.
If the goal is to be present in the moment and sort of living what I'm doing in the moment, How does that
impact the idea that I like to read a book and talk about it a
lot, or watch a movie and talk about a movie? What am I doing when I'm doing that? I mean, I'm not really in the moment when I'm talking about something I read or saw earlier.
So your question has to do with...
Is conversation not living in the moment?
Again, conversation can be in the moment or it cannot be in the moment. It depends on where you are investing your attention during the conversation. If you're being present within the conversation, so you're actually listening to what's being said rather than just on sort of remote, you know, just automatic pilot, and just going with whatever thoughts like that, then you don't have a location. But you can always bring yourself back to your body and speak from a point of reference. You find your conversation isn't quite as lengthy, that it says something much more concise and exact, that it's much more to the point, that it's much more aligned with what you truly want to say and the truth about your experience. When you give yourself over to the imaging, into the papancha of it, you'll just go wherever the thoughts will take you. Try to have a conscious conversation and see what it feels like.
I've been working with the practice that you talked about in week three of the sort of separating the story and the emotion, when the emotion comes up and following the emotion. And I'm able to do that, but I find that the story is still there. It still lingers, and it comes back later, comes back the next day, comes back the next day. And is the practice that eventually will kind of go away somehow?
She says that she's been practicing just feeling the emotion without the story, but she finds that the story reoccurs the next day and the next day. And so it has a prolonged effect on it, and her question is, will that storyline ever go away? It takes a while. Because it's hard to get a sense that I can have an emotion without trying to justify why I'm having it, or to find a reason that I'm having it. We look out beyond ourselves to sort of put the pieces together, so, oh, this is why I'm feeling what I'm feeling. And what we're really doing is trying to find a causation so that we won't have to be completely accountable and responsible to the feelings we're having. That's why we need an explanation. So as that begins to dawn on you, first of all, that the explanation, I mean, you have an emotion, certain conditions that we've become habituated to. When certain conditions arise, an emotion arises. It's based on a certain conditional aspect of our life. We try to say, I'm feeling this because of these conditions. You're feeling this because you're feeling this. And these conditions are arising. But the feeling is yours. It's not coming from some external source, you see. So when we're no longer willing to look outside ourselves for the responsibility of it, then you really get comfortable with the feeling and it being okay. It doesn't need an explanation. And when it doesn't need an explanation, you don't have to act it out. And you also have a discerning quality that comes in place of the explanation that allows you to see more clearly what's going on that had those feelings, that led to those feelings arising within you. You see, and it's that discerning clarity that allows you to then act in accordance with a more direct and confirming interaction than a blame or an accusation or a sort of a floundering within the field of the emotion itself. Does that make sense to you? Yeah.
You talked about rain a couple of weeks ago, and when I'm sitting and having a feeling, to investigate, how do I do that without thinking?
Okay, the question is using the acronym RAIN when we're having a feeling. We're inviting in an inquiry, and part of that is going to have some thought associated with it. But it's a confluence of thought and meditation. So you say, okay, recognition, that's a thought. What is this emotion? That's a thought. Then you're actually experiencing the emotion to see what it is. That's a meditative moment, right? So it's the confluence of thinking and meditating. Okay, so that's R. Allowance. Okay, let me relax. Release the need to protect myself from this and just feel it for what it is. So you're giving yourself that little speech, and then you're actually doing it, which is the meditative component, right? So that's the A. Interest. Okay, so am I interested in this, or do I just want it to go away? So then it's a meditative moment as to whether you're interested or you're just trying to be aversive to it, you see? So, I'm not really interested. Let me see if there's some curiosity about this. Now you're inviting thought to actually lead you in the direction of curiosity. You see how those things work together? Yeah, that's okay. Yes, sir.
And now, when you're trying to wish a really difficult or even evil person well, and you realize that it's not really going to make any practical difference, and then that makes you realize that you're only doing it for yourself to change your own state of mind. How do you get beyond the fact that, well, in a sense, I'm being phony, I know I'm not going to...
Okay,
I'm
so you're... Wait. Okay, stop. You're going off. It's for Pancha, okay? Just reel yourself back in here. This does have an impact. It does have meaning. It does have purpose. He's talking about metta. That I'm not watching an evil person. That's just my own. Don't. This is... You're looking below. No one is evil. Behaviors, actions are unskillful or skillful. But no person is intrinsically evil. They're all human beings. They didn't start out that way. When they were children, they were a human being. And they learned conditionally how to act in order to survive. Some of them learned unskillful actions in order to survive. We call that whatever you want to call it. Okay? So I don't believe that a person's behaviors is the totality of what that person is. Okay? So I'm going to look below their behaviors. Their behaviors are unskillful. I'm going to see if I can reconnect with them on the human level, which is much more of the truth of their being rather than the way I interpret their behavior. So let me just see if I can connect on that. Don't pick the most evil person in your life. Don't pick the one that's the most difficult. We suggested ones that you're having little disagreements with. That's an easier invitation to see them as a human being. The one that, you know, rammed your car may be too much for you. So you just go, okay, so let me just see this person as a human being. What you'll find is you start where you have denied access of your heart, to the field of humanity. You begin to open your heart to the field of humanity. That allows you to feel much more comfortable, less judgmental, much more inclusive. That serves not only you, it also serves other people who you interact with. It's not just changing my opinions. It's really looking more specifically at what this person is as opposed to my opinions about the people. Opinions is a very small tension level of abstraction that governs most of our life. I have an opinion about you. I don't want any part of you. Well, let me re-invite a different reference to you so that I can open to you once again. That, to me, makes sense. You're allowing life to come back in. What you find is, eventually, you don't want to leave anyone out of your heart.
I'm wondering if it's ever useful to have this story about emotions, like if somebody is a trauma survivor or struggles with mental illness.
Trauma survivor or mental illness, is it ever useful to have the story? Okay, so that's a different level of severity. For very deeply embedded and traumatic histories, that needs a professional to sort of work with that consciousness separately from what I'm saying. If you just open to the traumas of your life, you'll get flooded and it'll be too much for you. Okay? So that's a very special example, a very special occasion. That should be done in a different kind of way. Right? But for most of us, we don't have that severe trauma. We have trauma, we have difficulties, but it hasn't been so overwhelming that if we open to that experience, we get flooded and can't hold ourselves to the place where we are. So it's to the majority of us that I'm speaking, but to those few people who do have that, they need special attention and professional attention to help them with their, to help with them understand that story and the emotions that arise around it. Okay, so I'm going to interrupt and I'm going to give you homework and some other things. I want to talk about the day long and I want to talk about post-beginning class and so on. Okay, so the one thing I want to mention in terms of homework is that I would like you to take a 2-day news fast this week. Can you believe that? A 2-day news fast. You're not listening to news, you know. PBO. Anyway, okay, so why I'm suggesting that is you don't realize what you're putting in here and what it's doing to you. And unless you intentionally take a fast and see what it does to you, not to listen to the news, and the news is one of the... I mean, do you really need to know who won the New Hampshire primary on Tuesday? You can wait until Friday. It doesn't change anything. In fact, you can wait until November next year. The point is, though, that it has, you don't realize the impact that what we're taking in has on our psyche. And so you just intentionally, you slept out of intent, just gone away for a couple of days and turned off the radio? We're not asking any more of you than to fast for a couple of days in terms of the input that you're taking in. Just see what effect it has on you to live free of that input. You might find it very interesting. You might want to prolong it for a while. Okay, so just 2 days. I always get the same reaction. It's amazing to me. It's like, get 8 hours sleep. What? Get 8 hours sleep? Oh, my goodness. Get 8 hours sleep. See what it does for you. So that's, yes.
Would that entail a Twitter, Facebook break as well?
I can't imagine backing away for 2 days from Twitter. I'm just suggesting. You can spin off on your... I had an interesting thing happen today. So Ellen and I were out on a bridge at Madison Park, and this couple asked me to take a picture with their iPhone. So I don't have it, one of those things. So I turned it backwards. So they could see my eyeball. And I said, I can't see you. I said, and they said, now what? Oh. I don't have a phone on this phone. So I find myself, I'm not missing a thing. I don't think I'm missing anything. I don't think I'm missing a thing. So I'm not going to tell you not to use it if you think you're missing something, but just don't use it. Try to take 2 days away from it. I don't know. Or just, all I'm suggesting is a 2-day news fast. That's all. You have to see what the input does to you before you to realize that you want to put it down. You can't just make a decision, I'm not going to think anymore. You have to see what thinking does to you. You have to see the tensions, the stress, the burden that time puts you on. When you see it, you realize at a different level. You can't just do this cognitive. Oh yeah, I think that's a good idea. A thought doesn't go anywhere in this business. We have to actually realize, see directly, oh my God, I can't believe how I'm being pushed around by my thinking in terms of time. And then you will make a clear decision based upon that realization, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to follow those thoughts anymore. You see, so that's what I'm trying to get you to do, is to come up against the realization of what your mind is doing to you. Okay.
I guess I'm curious, as someone who, I have a hard time imagining not wanting to move forward. I'm thinking a lot about what you said about time. So if I want to make a change in the world because I don't like how something is, then I have to plan for that, and I have to take steps towards that, which requires me to think about time. And I guess I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about that.
Say a little more about time. No, I'm just trying to paraphrase, yes,
okay.
For the camera. Just say a little more about time.
Okay.
That's it. Instead of concerning yourself by how you could ever live without it, I want you to look and see what it does to you. I want you to get a sense of how driven most of us are, all of us are really, by the need to think ahead of ourselves, and whether we have to live that way. Because when you do, you don't really ever meet life as it's occurring. Very practical. You know, I kind of dismiss this moment for where this moment may be taken. I would just want you to get a sense of how much of your life is spent at the expense of the present. Okay? Let that churn its own conclusions for you. Right? So I'm not taking you away from time. I'm asking you to look and see what it's doing to you already. And see whether that mandates or encourages a changing of the way that you look at time. Now I don't want you to, what will often happen when you come across something that you don't think you can do, like I can't live without time, your ego, your egoic sense of you will start arguing against doing it at all. You'll say, I can't live like that. It would make me I'll never plan. I'll be dysfunctional. It'll shut the whole thing down. That's what it'll do. And it'll do it over and over and over again. It has a very good understanding of what arguments work for you, because it is you. So, what you have to do is say, okay, I'm not listening to that. I want to see for myself. I want to see if there's something else that arises when I'm not dependent on time. If something else comes into the forefront that allows me to discern, see clearly what I need to do outside of the pressures that time puts me under. Maybe it's a clearer choice I have when I'm outside of those pressures and a clearer idea of where I need to go and what I need to do, as opposed to when I'm under the pressure of time and the forced having to do it the way that time says I must. See, there's two different mechanisms there. You never know the second unless you escape from the first. And you're afraid to escape from the first because you don't think there's a second. I'm suggesting there is a second. Or we would all, why would we have shown up here on time? None of us would have. None of us have been, we wouldn't have known where to go. Ella, where are we going? We got here before you did.
So you're not suggesting that we can't also have a career and all that? You're not suggesting any of that? Well, because I mean, I think a conclusion from that, if you just look at just what you exactly said, you could say, well, then you should be spending your time meditating and looking at the current moment.
No, I'm not suggesting that there isn't a confluence, an interface between how time by the clock, I have 8 minutes to get you out of here, and the internal mechanism of pressure.
Okay.
I can see the clock and discern what needs to happen without the internal pressure. I don't need the internal pressure to say it's time to go. Listen, we've got to speed up here. I don't need that. It doesn't help me. Well, I would rather, we have time. See? And when you do have time, you know what you have time for? To be quiet. Because something might not come up immediately. It's like, have you ever been in a socially awkward situation where you forced conversation?
Yeah.
We all have, right? Okay. So what if you just were quiet? That's the ego. I can't do that. What would the person think of me? It'd be surprising what the person might think of you. So just experience this for a second. Because we all have the capacity, see, it's not me doing it to you. We all have the capacity to be quiet at any moment. There. How bad is that? It feels delightful to me. Now, what did you have to say, sir? What did you have to say, ma'am? Oh, okay. Yeah. Then I respond, and yeah. Okay. Yes, no. Turn right. I don't know. I call that sanity. I hope you do as well. Let's just be quiet for a moment. No pressure, he says. No pressure on you. Nobody's asking anything from you. Not even yourself. The internal pressure by far is the worst. In fact, all pressure is internal. just experience a moment or two. Okay, thank you for coming.